Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response a day for the second day of Rosh Chodesh Tammuz. And today we're going to see a response of the Chatam Sofer from the second volume, Yoredeya, Part 2, Siman 239, Reish Lamedtet, response 239, written on the second day of Rosh Chodesh Adar. Sorry, the second day of Rosh Chodesh Tammuz Tav Kuf Samach Bet, which was 1802. The question that was posed to him has to do with a fire that erupted. It erupted in the house of a non-Jew, so it's not like there's any Jew at fault here. But then many of the houses of the Jews in that particular town or city, the way they phrase it in the question is Ruba de Minkar Mirechov Hayudim, a clear majority of the homes in the Jewish street of the town were burned down to the ground. So, and people collected funds, and from all over the world, or all over the area, but near and far, people sent money to help rebuild this town or this city. And the question was, how do you divide it? Meaning there's never enough money to just give everybody what they need, so you have to split up the money. And they wanted to know from the Chatam Sofer something that would be the way the Torah says to split it up, or karov lazeh, or close to the Torah way, so that everybody... The phrase in the response is "Shekol echad am kamo yavo b'shalom." Everybody will come to their place in peace. But the point is, or the meaning is, that everybody can agree that this is a reasonably fair or equitable division of the assets. So the Chatam Sofer says, "Yaduish etvarim elu kaelu yirshal dani dividin Torah mamish." There's no actual din Torah here. There's no actual halachic definition of who gets what. And I think that's an important point because I've heard people today who think or who will assume that, oh yes, there's an halachic answer to every question and you can certainly answer it in a very clear and definitive way halachically. And the Chatam Sofer is saying very clearly, at least about this case, it's not true. But there is a way to do it karov l'din. In other words, I can take human logic, and I can take what we have at halacha, and I can find something close to ideas that will help us out. So these are going to be his suggestions based on concepts that we have. Now, sometimes concepts that we have are sufficient to actually tell us what we need to do in the current situation. He's not saying that. He's saying the concepts that we have applied logically and reasonably can give us some guidance. Okay, and he's going to start with the world of tzedakah, the world of charity. Because after all, these people, for all that they were not charity cases until now, they are now having been damaged greatly and needing assistance getting back on their feet. They have some relevance to the halachos of tzedakah. Then he puts in a prayer that Hashem should help him figure out and understand this appropriately so that he can give the right answer. So his starting point is, the Mishnah in Peah, towards the end of Peah, says... Now, Peah is a masechet of missions, a tractate of mission that deals with some of what are called matnot aniyim, which is that the Torah set up in the agricultural society certain ways to take care of the poor. So one is Peah, which was where you leave a portion of your field unharvested and the poor were allowed to come get that. And then there's also leket and there's shikcha. There's different things in the course of harvesting that are left for the poor, however it happens. Right? So leket will be if the farmer or whoever is doing the harvesting drops a certain amount, or drops a couple of grains while he's going, the poor can follow after them and pick that up and get that. Mishnah says, whoever has matayim zuz shouldn't be taking leket, shikcha, and peah. Whoever has 200 zuz has too much money, in other words, is too wealthy, not wealthy, but is not yet under the poverty line such that they have the right to take these matnot aniyim, to participate in the gathering of these matnot aniyim. Chatam Sofer, this is not his novel idea, it's just that he says it here, points out that this 200 zuz is not a definitive amount of money. It is shi'ur mizonotav lishana. It is the amount of money that person needs to support himself to have food for a year. And the point of the mission is, this year's harvest he doesn't need because he has money for the year. Let him live out the year. If nothing happens to help him find his way to greater wealth, the next year he'll be able to collect in the harvest. But he has enough to take him through that year. In the Yerushalmi, they say, and they point out that this accounting of 200 zuz does not take into account if he owes money to people, as long as those people don't have the immediate right to collect that money. So, for example, let's say the man is married. So that 200 zuz would have to then be an amount that covers not just him, but his family for the year. But also, theoretically, if they were to get divorced or if he were to pass away, he's supposed to take care of her financially. That's part of the obligations of a husband in the ketubah. So her ketubah should maybe count against that 200 zuz, and we would say he doesn't need 200 zuz, he needs 400 zuz, because 200 of them he has to set aside to make sure that he has money for her. So the Yerushalmi says it's not true, that we don't count that in this count, because that's not something she can collect while he's still alive, as long as they're still married, and therefore it's not an immediate need, and therefore it doesn't enter into the accounting, meaning that, let's say he only has 200 zuz, and they spend down all their money, she'll be stuck, but nonetheless, in terms of him being allowed to consider himself poor, in terms of needing leket shikren, being having the right to be part of the collection of leket shikren pay, of those agricultural gifts for the poor, doesn't have the right. As we move forward, as the Chatam Sofer is going to apply this elsewhere, it matters for lots and lots of questions, right? We're going to say the standard of being poor is that you don't have enough money to last for a year. Well, there's another version of that we'll see in a second that will have to do with employment, maybe, and things like that. So that's not the end of the question. But whatever the standard is, that would suggest that anybody who lives up to that standard does not then have the right to collect money from charitable organizations for various needs. That could affect lots of issues, like what's the standard of poverty for getting tuition assistance in schools and things like that. That's not our topic here. Our topic here is these people are trying to take money from a charitable fund that's set up to compensate people for losses and to help them rebuild their lives. His first starting point is that you have this standard of 200 zuz. That 200 zuz is counted to the exclusion of long-term debts that aren't immediately collectible. That would mean, however, if he has short-term debts, meaning if within the course of the year there's a debt for 25 zuz that he has to pay off, then he would need 225 zuz, because that 225 zuz is going to come up in the year. And if he has to spend down his money now and he only has 200 zuz, he's going to make that creditor lose money, and that we don't allow. And there he would already be allowed to start collecting like a chicken pay. In that same discussion, the 200 zuz is one standard, but then another standard they have is that whoever has 50 zuz, which is obviously much less, but that 50 zuz is being used, the phrase in the Mishnah is no save and obtain by him. He's doing business with them. In other words, he's got money that's actively earning money, so he too cannot take leket shikhen peah, the assumption being, as Chatam Sofer points out, that in their times, 50 zuz that's being actively used in business was sufficient to provide the sustenance for a year. That would seem to be that the 50 zuz will earn him over the course of a year at least 150, because that would be a total of 200. That will carry him through the next year, and then by the next year, he'll have spent down all his money, and he'll have the right to take leket shikhen and peah. Now, Chatam Sofer infers, actually, that he thinks that if there's long-term debts here and this is investment money, he's not sure that you'd have the right to just spend it down, and therefore it might have to be that you have to have slightly more, he says maybe 70 zuz, because then you could earn enough off of it to pay off the debt as well as support himself for the year. But in any case, somewhere around there, if you have the money that he says in their times, you had the right to assume you're going to make three times your investment money. So that's quite an investment environment that you had at the time. I'm not sure that today we would assume you can make three times the investment money. That would affect all of these numbers, meaning if somebody is going to use their money in a business, depending how much you put in, the return is generally not three times as much as the money you put in, whereas they seem to be assuming that it was. The Chatam Sofer is pointing out. There's a side discussion that I'm not going to get into, where the Gemara elsewhere seems to assume that you don't make quite that much money, because it talks about if a woman brings property into the marriage and the husband has to pay her some of the value of what he earns. So there it seems to assume that he doesn't make three times as much, he only makes 1.5 times what he put in. But there the Chatam Sofer thinks that's because the woman would prefer to be guaranteed the 1.5 times, and since she wants to leave the money for her ketubah, she'll take less than his actual return. But his actual return rate seems to be in their times that you could reasonably expect a 300% return on your investment. The Smak, however, says this whole halacha doesn't apply in our times. The Beis Yosef quoted that in terms of the 200 zuz, that if you have 200 zuz, that's enough for a year. but doesn't quote the whole idea that the 50 doesn't apply. So the Chatzim Sofer says that it's clear to him that all of these numbers are dependent on the time. So whatever it takes today to support somebody for a year would be the equivalent of 200 zuz, and whatever money today is such that you continue making money off of it that can support you, that would be the amount. So whatever that would be, right? So if somebody's in a business where they can expect to make to earn their money, their investment money back every year, if there were such a business, that'd be a good business. But I have to live off it as well, and whatever. So that would be the money's involved. Doesn't talk about here, what if somebody has employment from outside of them, right? They're not on their own. They're employed by a company that we could expect to this. So then that would seem to be similar to the person has the right to expect. That's sort of like investment money because it's going to keep going as far as we know. And that would affect it. So the question of, he's trying to establish, what do we consider poor people? It would be somebody who has no means of income and has savings such that they can last for a year and then their savings will be all gone. That unless that's the standard, and that's the standard, until that point that you have less than a year's savings and no prospects for earning money, we would not necessarily, the Chatzim Sofer say, consider that person poor for many poverty purposes. That gets to be an interesting question in lots of other areas, as I've said, but we're going to stick with our area here. In addition, if somebody has money that they can invest and they can use in some productive way, and that will provide them a livelihood, that person as well will not be considered poor. Summing up that part of the conversation, the Chatzim Sofer says, "B'chol ze'ani navok v'biyadi davar bur." I don't know exact numbers or exact amounts for any of these things, and it would take a lot of investigation, a lot of thinking in order to come to firm conclusions. We're going to come to firm conclusions for our discussion here about this city and this town and how they split up their stucca funds in a second. But he's saying it's not clear to him that all these things are true in exactly this way, what the numbers are, what we would do about it. He also has a whole discussion about whether or not when we figure out the amount of money the person has that he can use as investment money or as money that he plows into his business and can expect to make money back off of it, there the ketubah issues might be different because since he's continuing to earn money, right? So if a man has a job, the amount of savings we require him to spend down, he has a job that can expect to make $40,000 a year. And he's going to continue making that. So then we might say that even if he has less money in the bank than somebody else, since he has continuing employment that will continue to provide him funds that will continue to support him, so that might be that he's not yet thought of as a poor person. And there also we might not require, though, if we're going to start thinking, worrying about whether he has enough money, meaning his job doesn't pay him enough to continue supporting him, there the Chatzim Sofer thinks that we might also include the ketubah, his obligations, his long-term obligations, as factors on his balance sheet that we will weigh and take into account when we consider whether we consider this person poor or not in terms of taking stucco funds. Another issue that comes up is also whether or not we require a person to sell their assets. So that becomes a big question today. Let's say the person owns a house and there's equity in the house. How much do we require them to either borrow against that equity or sell the house or sell other possessions that they have in order to be allowed to collect stucco funds? This can become a very tense issue in certain situations because you have people who at some point in their lives were prosperous and then they lose their money for whatever reason, which is really the situation in this case that he's talking about here, because you have people who were otherwise prosperous and now their houses have burned down. They need to rebuild the house and that can be a significant investment. And let's say they may have also had furnishings that burned down. They have to replenish or restock those furnishings in their houses of furnishings. And maybe they still own some things that are very valuable. Do we require them to sell them? So the halacha in general is that we don't require poor people to sell their property. It's not their property. We don't require them to sell clay tashmishim shalahem, their actual furniture that they use. So their bed and their table and the stuff that they actually use, we don't require them to sell. And the original halacha was, or the way the halacha stated is that that's true even if it's very valuable. Meaning, let's say somebody was at some point very wealthy and now they've gone down in wealth. So an example today was that somebody had a really expensive car and then they lost a lot of money, however it happened, sadly. Now we're going to make them sell the car before we would, and buy a cheaper car before we would give them any stucco funds. That's a hard question about cars. But here we're talking about, let's say they have a golden table or a silver table that they eat off of. So it's their table. So the general halacha was that they're not required to sell that. Again, today that becomes a very sensitive issue because people are bothered by the idea that you see somebody who has sadly become poor, and they don't deny that, but they have all of this stuff that they could sell. So the halacha really is you don't generally make them sell it. But the Taz wrote that it seems clear to him And when that halacha was recorded and was paskened, was ruled, that was when people ate off of small tables, right? So if people ate off their own personal small tables, eat a small silver table, that's what we leave them and we don't make them sell. But he says in our times, when you have large tables, because all of the members of the household eat together, he thinks that it's clearly true that you'd have to sell it if it's very valuable, because when we say, Misajin the Baal Chov, the Taz says, that's for him and not for the wife or the children, that they have to have also the things that they're used to, in which case, if this table serves all of them, you'd have to sell it. Right, you'd also have to sell it. So he says, if what he means by the members of his household, that it's like when you have somebody who owes money, we do these things, that would be one thing. It's a little strange, though, he says, because the wife and children are also impoverished. So they, too, need what... So one of the standards here that's important to remember is what's called de machsoram. It's a hard concept, because de machsoro means that if somebody was once wealthy and they become poor, ideally... It doesn't usually work out because we don't usually have the communal funds to allow for it. But ideally, we're supposed to help them get back to the standard of living they were used to. That can be troubling to some people because it clearly means that if you have somebody who lived a wealthy lifestyle, which means there are plenty of people around who can't afford that lifestyle, and then sad things happen to this person and they lose their money so they can't live with that lifestyle anymore, our goal in halacha really is to help them get back to it. And there's problematic moral issues there, because let's say somebody lives high on the hog and then all of a sudden they lose their money, then all of a sudden it becomes our responsibility. The Gemara does talk about Hillel. The Chazal does mention this. I just always have known this. It's a Rashi in Chumash too, I think, that Hillel knew a man who had used to have a horse, and he had an attendant who ran before him on a horse, and Hillel ran before this man on a horse as part of trying to give this man stuck of funds. So that's the underlying reason also of allowing these people to use, to retain their expensive furnishings, because he's used to eating off of a table of silver. He always did, and now he's become poor. We don't make him sell the table of silver. So that's de machsoro. So the Chatzim Sofer says, but I understand, they had a large table of silver, and they were all eating around the table. It's de machsoram for the wife and the children as well. They're also now poor. They also should have the right to live the lifestyle that they were used to. Now, I know the troubling part of it. I would just point out the other side of it is that I think the Torah is telling us that it's very, very difficult for people when they become used to a certain standard of living. The need to come down from that standard of living is very problematic, it's troubling to them. It's distressing to them. And part of our dealing with the poor is to help them get over their distress. So there's two sides to this question, and I think they need to be balanced. The Chasam Sofer is not really dealing with it. He's just taking for granted that we strive for day machsoro, and that that means that in very many situations we don't require the impoverished people to sell the assets they immediately use, right? Meaning if they have stuff in the bank or if they have investment property elsewhere, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the things that they need and they use, including even a very, very valuable table. So he says, if it's somebody who owes money to somebody else, there, that's not a poverty question. That's he owes money, so we would presumably make him sell everything. But here, it's a question of I'm sorry, the other way around. It should have been that you make him sell everything because he owes the other guy money. So the fact that the Torah made the halacha misajim lebaal chov, the halacha that we arrange it that even somebody who owes money to somebody else gets to hold on to his most immediate personal possessions, even if they're very valuable, the Chatzim Sofer says, that's a chiddush in the Torah. That's a novel idea in the Torah. It's not a logical idea. The logical idea would be if somebody owes money, they have to pay back the debt, even if that means it takes them into bankruptcy and they lose everything. Now, bankruptcy laws in America, I think they also don't lose everything. I think there are exceptions for houses, and that becomes an American law also, I think, a tense situation that people complain about, because sometimes people have very expensive houses and they're declaring bankruptcy and their creditors are getting pennies on the dollar, pennies on the dollar, and they're still living in these fabulous households. So the Chasam Sofer is saying that whole area is an area of halacha and a halachic declaration that's a chiddush, it's a novel idea. It's not the only logical, intuitive way to handle it. And therefore, maybe it's true that it only applies, the Taz would say, it only applies to the creditor himself and not to the wife and the children. But Chasam Sofer then immediately says, but even if that's true, and even if we paskin that way and we would sell this large silver table and use the money to pay off the creditors, leaving aside only the part of it that's for the husband, the wife and the children would now become people who are impoverished in day machsoram, and their right, if there's enough money to be restored to the standard of living they were used to, would kick into play, and therefore they would have the right to hope for and to look for funds such that they could get back to eating off of the silver tables. Another possibility just for the Taz is that the table was so big that it didn't only include the members of the family, it included whatever serving people they had, right? Whatever employees they had who would help them out with serving the meal, and maybe that's what they meant. They sell that part of the table because it's such a big table, they can sell that part of it. That's another possibility. So far we've had a couple of complications. One question is how much somebody is allowed to have in the bank, or how much money, some assets and useful money one can have and yet be allowed to take tzedakah funds, or the other way around, say it, who is not allowed to take tzedakah funds because they have too much money. Another issue is what kind of long-term loans are involved, and there we said long-term loans generally don't count for money that's static, but they do count for investment money. And third question was assets that they have and what they do have to sell, what they don't have to sell. And there it seemed to be like things that they use personally, they don't have to sell. Although there was some question whether that's only for the man of the house who's the creditor in this situation, or would be all of his immediate family who are also impoverished by these situations. And even if it doesn't include them, the Chatam Sofer thought that they would become impoverished and they have the right to try to get it back by virtue of the halacha and the Torah of Deim Machsoram, of being restored to the standard of living they were used to. Another issue that comes up now is, let's suppose somebody has relatives who are willing to support him. So does that person have to sell his assets, the things that he owns, in order to pay back a creditor, or in order not to pay a creditor, in order to be allowed to take matnot aniyim? So the Beit Yosef cites the Rambam's view that he doesn't have to sell anything if he's not taking communal funds. So if you know somebody who's poor and by virtue of their poverty is not able to pay back creditors, let's say that, and they're being supported by relatives, they're not required to sell their immediate use assets as long as they're being supported by the relatives. But if they come to try to get communal funds to take matnot aniyim, then we have to say you have to sell certain things and buy other ones that are less valuable, because there you're taking money away from other poor people and we have limited funds, and that's what you have, and that's the way we basket. The Chasam Sofer says, even though the person getting supported by relatives, he doesn't understand why that helps, because he's still in some sense taking matnot aniyim by virtue of the fact that he's not paying off his creditors in the right way, and therefore there's not enough money, as much money around. And it's also true that there might be other relatives who are close to these people, and they're not going to get as much stuck of money from these relatives because these relatives are busy supporting this person. Meaning, let's say this man's father is supporting him, but there are cousins who are also poor, and this man's father would have supported them as well, but he's using all his money to support this impoverished son. Whereas if the son were to sell his silver table and buy a wooden table, he'd have more money, and then in that sense, isn't he in fact taking away from other poor people? So the Chatam Sofer says that he thinks the answer is that as long as somebody is being supported in private from relatives and other people think of him as wealthy, that he thinks counts as v'hechazak debo. That's all part of, there's a mitzvah in the Torah that we should ideally, even before somebody becomes impoverished, find a way to keep them from becoming impoverished. So that's what this person counts as. He's not yet considered poor because we're keeping him at his standard of living. We'll be able to support him before he has to publicly declare his poverty. And the Chatam Sofer says that value of helping people never descend into public poverty is sufficient, that there's a mitzvah to give the money to that person, for the relatives, to give the money to that person beforehand. And because it could be that by virtue of this aid, it'll get these people over their rough spot, and then they'll return to their situation, and then you'll never have them become poor in any whatsoever. Whereas when you give it to real poor people, so they've already sort of fallen out of the system. And since they've fallen out of the system, you're not really doing anything, not that you're not doing anything of value, but you're not doing anything that is that is going to have long-term impact, meaning feeding this poor person for today, but I have no horizons by which I can think that this is going to make the situation better in general. Whereas with the relatives who are supporting a person in their current lifestyle, so, you know, the example would be, let's say somebody was in some well-paying profession and they lose their job, and it's taken them several months to get their job, to get a new job, and they've eaten into their savings, so they don't really have savings anymore. And the question is, what do we do? Do we make them sell their house and sell their car and move and this and all that upheaval, whereas they have relatives who are willing to support them? And the relatives who are willing to support them is money that comes from somewhere. That's money those relatives won't be giving to other tzedakot, and therefore, in that sense, there's less money around for the poor. So in some sense, it's taken from the poor, even though they're not selling their assets. But the Chatam Sofer is claiming that for those people, what we're really doing is we're maintaining them in their current life such that they can make strong efforts. Now, theoretically, you could say, well, if they sell their house and they move in the same neighborhood to an apartment, that doesn't prevent the man from finding his job again. I think the Chatam Sofer would be saying that once somebody gets out of the pattern of their current life into a poverty pattern, that changes everything. Now, he was already been clear that a lot of this depends on the economy of the time, so it could be, you could say, in our economy that's not true, and these would be, as he said, issues to bring up each and every time in each and every economic situation. But the general claim would be that if we are able to maintain somebody in their current life, there's an added element that gives them a greater claim to the tzedakah money, in that we are fulfilling not only supporting them, but v'hechazaktabo. We are helping them stay where they are such that there's the hope they can return to their former life soon and won't need tzedakah funds anymore. One more element that the Chatam Sofer points out was that even people who are able to take money, tzedakah money, so in the extent of the mission, it was if the person had less than 200 zuz, right, they had less than a year's support and a way of earning money that we know of, they can already accept tzedakah money and gather matnot aniyim and gather the agricultural gifts to the poor. But the Chatam Sofer says, while that's true, he still thinks that if you're going to give money, you should give to the more poor person. So he comes to me and says, listen, I have 190 zuz. They're perfectly allowed to collect tzedakah money, but somebody else only has 10 zuz. So 190 zuz would cover that person for 19/20 of the year. The person who has 10 zuz is only going to cover him for 1/20 of the year. So he's saying we would give preference to the person who has less, I think presumably because we have more of an emergent situation, because he's going to run out sooner, whereas the other person, who knows what could happen, maybe something would happen and they would find their way back to solvency. Nonetheless, even though that's true, he thinks that Mechazaktabo might take priority over those as well, because it's stopping them from falling down. All that having been said, he gives now some specific advice for this particular situation. He thinks that this tzedakah fund counts as being supported in Bitsina by relatives, because there are many people in this town who were wealthy, and if not wealthy, so they were solidly middle class, able to support themselves, not living beyond their means. And the fire is a completely, in their times, it wasn't an unexpected event, but it was not something you could prepare for. So in their times, I don't know if there was insurance that somebody could build off of that and use the insurance, but the point being that it was not unexpected, but it wasn't something you could prepare for in that way, and therefore they qualify as people who are being supported, because this fund now will help keep them going in all the ways that we had said, and therefore that would be the standard to use in the fund. He also thinks that in the current environment, since there's not a lot of money around in this town, because money itself is a short supply, meaning not assets or value, but money is in short supply. If we made people sell their land and assets, especially their houses, if they have them, or other houses that they have, they'd have to sell it at such a low price. So in this situation, he thinks you don't have to count that in terms of figuring out who has how much assets, because we don't force people to sell immediately, like in a literal fire sale, because the loss of money there isn't worth it, and therefore he doesn't think you have to count that. He also thinks that loans that a person has to pay off within a year, those monies will not be counted as part of that person's assets, because he has to pay it off within a year, but longer term loans will not count against his definition of assets, because what we're thinking here is if you just get people back into their situation, then everything will go back to what it is, and therefore it is, so that you can't get that. He thinks that in their times, in their situation, if you operate locally, if the person lives in a certain place and makes his living selling whatever he's selling in that place, then he has 200 zuz or 200 whatever the money currency was would be enough to support that person. I'm sorry, somebody who goes around to the areas only needs 200 zuz. beyond the issue of having a house and finding a house, whereas somebody who has a local store and just stays local, they would need 400 even. And all of this is, some people have more family members, some people have fewer family members. Obviously, those numbers would change. He's just saying what he thinks the average requirement would be, and then everybody has to adjust it. So in these situations, then you would give out the monies depending on who qualifies to what level of poverty. Right? If people have rich relatives who are helping them out, he thinks that that would be a different situation. Those people should probably come off of this list for who's going to take money from this fund. But if they only got a little bit from a relative and it's not enough to make up for what they've lost, then they could include themselves in this list. And therefore, in this chalukah, you would do it. So then he goes through the whole list. It's not really relevant to us. He says that you have some people will take a third and a half, depending on their level of need and their level of funds and of assets. You would give them proportional amounts, whatever it is. Those specific numbers aren't our point, and we're running out of time, so I'll just summarize and point out that the Chatzim Sofer is pointing out that these are the factors taken to come into account when we're giving out limited stock of funds for an immediate emergency or for a longer-term question. They're the question of who are the people who are generally solvent and generally living a lifestyle and something terrible has happened to them. There, not only is there a stock issue, there's a chagzaktable issue. There's an issue of helping them stay or restore them to their status or hold on to their status, whatever, they become poor. That's an important value. Then it's in terms of figuring out who's poor, there's a question of assets, there's a question of monies that one can continuing income that one can be relatively confident about. Then there's the question of loans and what people owe. There's a question of what other sources of support they have. Relative supporting them might be important for two factors. One, whether they can take money, and two, whether we would think that they would need to sell their own property or go down to a lower level of property in order to be able to have the right to take money from the poor, from the relatives, who after all will therefore not support other poor people. There he assumes they don't have to, but if the people then turn to the communal funds, there's more reason to suggest, since those funds are very often limited, there would be more reason to suggest that they would be required to sell some of those assets. And these are some of the factors that the Chatzim Sofer brings into play, or most of the factors that the Chatzim Sofer brings into play when trying to figure out how to use limited communal funds to restore people after a fire that had destroyed much of a Jewish neighborhood, and how to try to do our best to bring everybody back to where they want, to the best we could. And that is a response of a day for the second day of Rosh Chodesh Tammuz. Have a good day.